Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Alan Taylor, who is Professor of Economics at the University of California, Davis. Alan and I met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in New Orleans in January 2008, and we talked about what we can learn from economic history about the current process of globalization. We touched on three broad areas: financial market integration, trade liberalization, and the growth of international reserves. But I began by asking him generally about the boom in research on the first wave of globalization 100 or so years ago.
Well, this seems to be taking off in quite a big way in research, both among economic historians and among international economists. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. The first is that we are witnessing an era of globalization which is unlike anything we've seen, except for a similar episode about 100 years ago. And the question is, where can you learn from the past and where should you draw lessons? Are there, you know, fair comparisons to be made, or is it a stretch? And so I think in terms of thinking about policymaking, the institutional environment, the types of macroeconomic shocks we have then versus now, there's really a challenge there for people to do careful empirical work to see where things match up and where they don't. But I think with a number of scholars in various departments around the world working on that topic, we are starting to get a deeper perspective on what the costs and benefits of globalization are and what the trade-offs are for policymakers. So, you know, we could cover a few examples of that, but I think that growth in that literature is sort of spurred basically by a desire to say, what precedents are there? And realizing that history, economic history, provides a much larger data universe, a much larger set of case studies, anecdotes, and the plural of anecdotes, data, from which we can draw a deeper understanding.
And what we're doing really is looking right back at the sort of what is often called the first age of globalization, so sort of late 19th century, early 20th century experience of globalization, and thinking about what we can learn from that and about why that era came to an end.
Right. So I think, you know, understanding how it happened, what impact it had both on domestic markets and on the world economy as a whole, is important, and also, you know, considering cautiously, you know, what happened that eventually put paid to that earlier era, and why globalization went into reverse in the interwar period. So, in terms of what we can learn, I think there've been a number of interesting studies that I might talk about. My own work with Maury Obstfeld and Jay Shambo has been focused more on the finance side. And Jay and Maury and I have written a couple of papers there, and Maury and I have written a book with Cambridge. And I think that's been, you know, very enlightening, at least for me, for us, to think about where the parallels are. So you have a period of financial globalization, of integration in capital markets, and this, you know, raises concerns today about, you know, is it eroding the independence of policymakers and so forth? And what our work tried to set out, using both contemporary data and data from the past, was to basically find evidence for what international macroeconomists call the trilemma. So the idea that as you move towards an environment where capital is mobile and markets are more integrated, the options for the central bank, the monetary policymakers, really shrink. We end up, if you like, going from the trilemma to the dilemma. There's a sort of bipolar choice. Do you want your monetary autonomy, or do you want exchange rate stability? And trying to document that empirically proved to be a bit of a challenge, but as we were able to assemble a database of interest rates, what policymakers were doing with monetary policy, and what exchange rate regime choices they were taking at the same time, and comparing that with this third dimension, international capital mobility, it really did seem that the data spoke very strongly to this, the existence and of the trilemma, and that it had some empirical content. And, you know, I think that's important. It's sort of like there's so many things in our textbooks that we take for granted, and we just say, well, theory just says this happens. But yet often when we go to the data, it's very hard to find sort of solid confirmation. And I think it's obviously really important in the present era because, you know, when fixed exchange rate regimes blow up, as they seem to do repeatedly, there's often big problems, particularly in emerging markets and developing countries. So anything that can put in the forefront of policymakers' minds and other people's minds that there are some real issues here and some trade-offs, I think does have some value in the long run.
Well, what about trade? I mean, that's an area where, you know, the people are anxious about growing protectionism, a sort of reversal of the process of liberalisation. And then, of course, there are some people who would like to see that.
Right.
I mean, what do we learn from looking at the past experience of trade opening it up and then being very much closed down?
You're absolutely right. That's another area where people are very focused on issues of distribution, how trade will affect domestic markets, who are the winners and losers, and the sort of, you know, the Doha round is teetering on the brink. And I think, again, it's very interesting to see how historical, longer-run perspectives are coming back into that debate. So to take a great example, Paul Krugman's recently writing on his blog and in the New York Times much more about economics and economic policy, and especially about trade. And there was an interesting post last week noting that, it's time to think long and hard again about the Heckscher-Ohlin model, which everyone had thought for a long time wasn't really explaining the facts very well. And it's sort of ironic that Paul himself, of course, developed new trade theory, or as it's now called, the old new trade theory, to sort of explain inter-industry trade between rich countries, which was a great model for the 70s and 80s. But of course, now in recent years, the growth of trade with developing countries and the emerging markets is huge. And that's trade between north-south, high-wage and low-wage, countries with very different endowments of skilled and unskilled labor, capital, and so forth. And so there we are starting to see more the classical Heckscher-Ohlin or Stolper-Samuelson effects, distributional effects on wages of skilled and unskilled, returns to capital. And so, again, that strikes me as Paul put it in the web post, you know, when the situation change or the facts change, you need to adapt to your theory. And that sort of resonates with how, as an economic historian, you approach the long run. You can't use the same model, the same approaches everywhere and in all times, but it's understanding when the world changes in a moment like, as you were saying, in the deglobalization of the interwar period, or after we've gone through a reglobalization in recent years, which countries are coming into the mix, how is that changing the structure of the market, and how can we use that to really make a better assessment of what's going on.
Now, you've also been doing some work on reserves, I understand, and you're looking at the sort of the build-up of countries' reserves in the emerging markets after the crises of the 90s. You're looking back at comparisons there in previous economic experiences.
Yeah. So the historical content of that is more history of thought than actual data. So this is very recent work, again, sort of with a trilemma flavour, with Maury Obstfeld and Jay Shambaugh. It's a paper that's about to probably appear as a working paper called Financial Stability, International Reserves, and the Trilemma. And the idea there actually goes back over 200 years to work by Henry Thornton, who was a pioneering theorist in Britain, a financier. He also was at the forefront of the campaign to abolish slavery. I think he was a member of parliament, and in his spare time he wrote a treatise that was probably the greatest macroeconomic treatise of the 19th century, so a bit of a daunting figure. But at the risk of getting into an arcane subject, he was called in by to basically do a study of what had gone wrong after the bank run in England, not this year, but in 1797, which was the first sort of modern bank run of that sort that had happened on that scale. During the gold standard, the Bank of England had to stop payment. There was a failure of country banks, small banks in the countryside, but people wanted to get out of paper, basically, and into gold, and that was they saw that as a safe haven until this temporary fright was over. And there were elements of self-fulfilling panic about this bank run, but it was interesting that at the end of the day, what they really wanted wasn't a note drawn on a safe bank or even a note drawn on the Bank of England. They wanted the Bank of England's gold. And Thornton was brought in to say, well, this is a complete joke, the way the Bank of England is operating. They don't have enough reserves. They haven't thought about this problem, which is, it's not just, paper notes in circulation or different the need to hold reserves, say, for an unfavorable balance of trade, the sort of classic, view of things, if you were taking a David Hume view, or you thought, there was possibly going to be a sudden stop in capital flows and you just had to pay for your imports with gold. He said, forget all that. There's this huge financial issue, which is, as you have a growing financial system, which Britain had at that time, you're going to have people with money on deposit in banks, which is quasi-money, but if it wants to suddenly flee, the central bank will need to keep reserves in proportion to that flight capital. And we thought, well, that's very interesting. Maybe we should be thinking about that in the present context, because currently theories have just failed to explain the growth of reserves, which of course a big part of global imbalances and all of these other issues about, you know, is China manipulating its exchange rate, et cetera, et cetera. But it's hard to evaluate whether someone's manipulating or doing a bizarre policy if you don't have a model that, you know, at least works as a benchmark. And what we found was, after we developed the theoretical model to sort of say why it is you might need this kind of reserve backing, is that we were able to do a much better job than either the sort of Bretton Woods era model of the 60s or the sort of Greenspan-Guidotti model of, you know, needing to hold reserves to cover debt. None of those models have really functioned, and it was a puzzle. But our model seems to do a little bit better. We can't explain everything that, you know, say China has been doing in the last 2 or 3 years, but our model does give some guidance that these countries are, to some extent, to use Marty Feldstein's phrase, self-insuring. And the thing that they're self-insuring against is not their base money in circulation, it's the quasi-money in their entire financial system. And that's interesting because going forward, they're still going to have more financial system growth. They're probably going to stick with their fixed exchange rates for a while. So this process may have some time to run.
So they might be learning from economic history without even knowing it.
Yeah, it would be interesting to go to Beijing and say, oh, have you heard of Henry Thornton? But, you know, they seem to have figured it out. Yeah.
But overall, this sounds like it's a booming time for the subject of economic history and looking at the past as a way of informing our understanding of the present.
I think that's right, and I'm very optimistic about that. I think it is drawing people in across disciplinary boundaries within economics, for example, in my own area in international economics, but I think also the growing interest in growth and institutions and topics of that sort also lends itself clearly to the long run in history. So I think it's a great time to be an economic historian and someone, you know, working on the global economies.
Alan Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.